Hey, everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass, and thanks for joining me today for another episode of It's All About Food. I promise you this is a special good one. I'm very happy about this one. I have in the studio today my guest, Philip Wolin, and in his early 30s, he was vice president of Citibank. The financial press rated him in the top 40, the brightest and best headhunted executives in Australia. Traveling the world, he saw egregious cruelty on such a massive scale that it affected him profoundly. And by the age of 40, he was an outspoken advocate for social justice. He describes himself as a venture capitalist for good causes. He decided to take everything he possessed, houses, factories, commercial buildings, apartments, share portfolios, everything, and give it away with warm hands and die broke. He has supported 500 humanitarian projects for children, animals, the arts, the terminally ill, and the environment in 40-plus countries. His words, articles about him, and speeches have been seen by tens of millions of people. One common thing of these projects is to have a strong pro-vegan theme. He has spoken in the Parliament, in The Hague, and in the Israeli Knesset, and in universities around the world. He has shared his view with presidents, heads of states, prime ministers, and ministers in many countries. In 2005, he received the Queen's Birthday Honours, the Order of Australia. In 2007, on Australia Day, he received the award Australian of the Year, Victoria. In 2012, he made an honorary fellow of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics. And in 2014, he received the Distinguished Alumni Award from the University of Adelaide. I am sitting here with Philip Wolin and his lovely partner, Trix, here in the studio in New York. They're both in from Australia. And I just can't believe I'm looking at these wonderful, beautiful, kind humans. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. It's very nice to be here.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I like to say sometimes when I have certain guests on the show that I have you on for selfish reasons. And this is certainly one of those days. So we're living in especially crazy times. Humans haven't really had a really terrific history. I mean, we've been pretty violent as long as I've known us, and a lot longer than that. And I don't know. Some people like to say it's getting better. But here in the United States, with our current administration, things, every day we learn of something scary. So when I heard you were here in New York, I selfishly wanted to meet you in person, be able to give you both a hug, because I need to hear about good people doing fantastic things for the planet, and you are. Thank you.
Thank you.
I heard about you, I think it was 5 years ago, when this video went viral here in the United States especially. It was a debate that you did called Animals Should Be Off the Menu with the St. James Ethics Wheeler Center. And I know for myself and many others, we all went crazy when we saw you as a vegan in a suit sharing why you thought it was important to keep animals off the plate, but you had a particular, I don't want to call it a Cinderella story. It's kind of like rather than rags to riches, riches to rags. But we love these kinds of stories, these Robin Hood kinds of stories, where people who have had everything give it away for good and for the purpose of good. So let's back up and talk about that.
Sure. I was, as you mentioned earlier, I was vice president at Citibank. I was running the mergers acquisitions business, a particularly brutal, hard-driven kind of segment of corporate banking. And in the course of my job, I went out to have a look at an organization that had interests in a number of industries. One of them turned out to be a slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, it absolutely terrified me. It affected me so profoundly. At the time, my favorite food was filet mignon and lobster, a fact for which I am so profoundly ashamed today. But what I saw that day absolutely terrified me. And I came out and I decided thereafter to become a vegetarian. I didn't know anything about the dairy industry. I always thought it was fairly bucolic, calm, beautiful, Wordsworth and Shelley environment of cows in a meadow with streams. But I happened to be on a business trip in India, and in the street I saw a man, a dairyman, dragging his injured cow to the slaughterhouse. The cow had been hit by a lorry and had broken her spine. She was in absolute agony. And he dragged her on a chain. She could barely move. And he was throwing chili powder into her eyes and shoving sharp objects up her anus. And besides her, he was her scrawny, starving calf. Hmm. Now, so many people in the West don't really understand that a cow won't give milk unless she has a calf. And the calf was starving literally to death. Anyway, he dragged her to the slaughterhouse gates. But before he handed her over to the slaughterman, the brute milked her. Mm. Now, if that doesn't change the heart of a man, nothing will. So when I came back to Australia, I decided I would study a little bit more about the dairy industry. And I found that this was a veritable gulag of despair. Milk is meat in liquid form. It's a cruel, nasty, squalid industry. And I decided to get off milk and dairy forms. And I didn't actually become vegan. Hmm. I just woke up one day and realized that's what I was. I wasn't eating any animal products. And I looked around and I discovered that my shoes weren't leather, nor was my belt and my watch band. I was a vegan without knowing what one was. So that really was, if you like, the metamorphosis of where I went.
I learned at a young age from Sesame Street that cows give much too much milk for their young calves to drink. That was the line that they said. I can't get it out of my head, but you know, it's a lie that they fed to children.
Well, the meat and dairy industry is the greatest scam ever perpetrated on this planet, period. There is no argument. There is no greater scam ever foisted on a gullible, credulous, ignorant species.
Okay, let's go a little further back. Why did you get into banking? Did you want to make a lot of money?
No, I was actually a migrant to Australia. I went to Australia as a teenage boy on my own. I didn't have my parents or anyone with me. And in those days, you had to pay a lot of money to go to university. So I did a lot of menial jobs, and I went to university part-time. And the only job I could get was in the finance industry. Hmm. And whilst I was going to university, and I did slightly better than average, I guess, I climbed the corporate tree, and very rapidly I moved up into the corporate finance field. It was never my intention. I don't think I had any particular talent to be a great investment banker at the time, but I grew into the role. And opportunities came my way, which I capitalized upon with some energy. And my career, as a consequence, was almost, one would say, meteoric.
Okay, I have to interject here and say that you are a humble person. And maybe you're being a little humble here in terms of your rise.
Well, my grandmother always said the same thing. She said, Philip is very humble. Very modest, she said, because he has so much to be modest about.
Sometimes I like to liken what goes on in the corporate world or with very wealthy people. Some of the myths and the stories we see, like the Lord of the Ring and the power of the ring, and how when people have wealth, they're kind of corrupted by it and want more of it. It's just this power that they can't separate from. And yet somehow you rose the ranks. You had a bit of affluence and power. How did you, you shared your story, but is that enough? I mean, a lot of people know this information, and yet they can't separate from that power.
Well, you make me sound much more intrepid than I really am. I have to tell you, once I saw the things I did, these were the easiest decisions I've ever made. Hmm. I've made harder decisions than this in a past life. My friends and colleagues in the banking and the corporate world thought I was insane.
Exactly.
But it seemed like such a, what we call them BGOs, blinding glimpses of the obvious.
But your friends and colleagues didn't get it.
No, I'm perplexed about that. Some of them.
Yeah.
At the time, they all thought I was going through a very premature midlife crisis, because I was actually in my late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought I'd outgrow it, and then they thought they'd make fun of me. And but you have to understand, people in the corporate world, and this is something most of the vegan activists don't understand, people in the corporate world are actually very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get that they're being stupid. And so please don't treat them that way. Enlighten them in an intelligent, calm, rational way, and you'll enlist their support. And if you deal with them in a respectful, intelligent way, you'll enlist an ally, not create an enemy. Many of the people that I've spoken to in the past who've rejected many of the things I was doing are my staunchest supporters.
Hmm.
They've become vegetarian or vegan, or if they haven't, they've become very avid protectors of the environment in other areas, or have taken on interests taking care of children, or supporting organizations like Amnesty, or organizations that take care of humans. Now, one may say that they're fairly anthropocentric, and I can live with that. Nobody's going to see the whole picture, but in time, I think they will see the logic of moving over to the other side and seeing the world through a vegan perspective.
I want to believe that, and I work towards that as well. Unfortunately, yes. It takes slow steps.
Yes, yes, it does. It takes positive steps. Some of them are slow and some of them are swift. But it needs strategy, needs consistency, a certain amount of firmness, and a resolute desire never to back down. And I think that gives me some sense of hope. But I also have, in a sense, a fairly apocalyptic view of the future.
Yeah.
Given that I see what I see, and as you know, we have projects in many countries. In human history, only 100 billion people have ever lived. 7.5 billion people are alive today. And we humans torture and kill 2 billion sentient, living, loving animals every week.
Mm.
We stab and suffocate 1 billion ocean animals every 8 hours. If human beings were exterminated at the same rate, we would be wiped out in one weekend. By 2048, all our fisheries will be dead. And they are the lungs and the arteries of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Oceans sequester more CO2 than all the forests of the world put together. Now, if any of the algorithms that I described, talking about the oceans and dead zones and our human health and matters like that, if any of those algorithms are true, and they all are, it means that no child under the age of 5 is ever going to reach retirement age.
Mm.
It is a mathematical impossibility. Now, if that does not chill your blood.
I became a vegan in 1988, and as a teenager, I didn't understand why people were starving. I just didn't get it. I became a vegetarian, and I still don't get it. And that was one of my choices, to not have children, just because
yes.
I saw the future, and it didn't look good. But still, I work towards a better future, because why not? That's the only thing I can do. But it does look pretty bleak. Now, you have the kindness trust. Let's
yes.
talk about just a few of the wonderful things that you do.
Well, we call it kindness trust basically in order to preserve some sort of anonymity. I don't like being...
The Philip Wallen Foundation didn't do it for you.
No, and it's not even...
Or the Philip and Trix Foundation. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't do any fundraising. The only money we spend is our own. We just didn't want people to know about us. And but basically, I focus on five key areas. We call it the five fingers: children, animals, the environment, the terminally ill, and aspiring youth. I would say about 80%, or maybe even more, of the effort, time, energy, money, attention, actually goes into the animal kingdom, because that is the most powerful positive vector force if you really want to affect all the other aspects, like taking care of children, human health, the environment, all those things. You get the animal industrial complex right, in other words, send them broke, and everything gets better. That rising tide floats all boats.
I agree with you.
Yeah, once again, it's a BGO. It's a blinding glimpse of the obvious. Mm-hmm. But the paradox is that farming won't change. Farmers would make money hand over fist. Farming wouldn't end. It would boom. Only the product line would change. These farmers would make so much money they wouldn't even bother counting it. And I'd be the first to applaud them. New industries would emerge and flourish. Health insurance premiums would plummet. Hospital waiting lists would disappear. Hell, we'd be so healthy, we'd have to shoot someone just to start a cemetery.
Okay. So you have this wonderful five-fingered mission or foundation to your foundation: children, animals, the ill, the environment, and aspiring youth. I just wanted to repeat that because it's worth repeating.
Right.
Yeah, and you have done just so many projects with that. You know, in coming here, I took the subway, and then I got out, and it's a rainy day, and every day I walk in Manhattan, I see just so many terrible things. It's upsetting, and it's numbing at the same time. I saw many people with signs, homeless or whatever, and begging for one thing or another. And you've said that, you know, when you see something, don't wait. You know, just do something about it. Here in Manhattan, it's kind of overwhelming. You just can't. Do you have any recommendations about that?
Yes, I'm always reluctant to give advice. The first thing I think anyone could do is get knowledgeable. And knowledge really is power. And the beauty about living today is that information is at your fingertips. You don't even have to have money to get an education now. You walk into a library and get on the mm-hmm. web, and you walk out a different person. I often say that when you become a vegan, everything changes to sort of take an idea developed by Salman Rushdie. He's not a vegan, of course, but by any means. But I say that veganism rearranges the furniture of your mind. You see everything differently. You go to the ballet and you see a beautiful woman in a fur coat. And in the past, I would walk up and talk to her and be friendly. And now I see some of my projects that shut down a fur factory, for example. And I see the blood-stained corpse on that beautiful woman who happens to think she's chic, mm-hmm. and she's anything but. You walk past a restaurant, and you look at the menu at the front door, and all I see is a smorgasbord of murderous opportunities. Everything changes. The way in which you see your friends, the way you see your interests, your hobbies, the way you see yourself. But once you change and become vegan, and it's such a corny word, but because people have hijacked it. You know, in the old days, people would say, you know, you've got the vegans have tattoos and dreadlocks and they don't take a shower. Well, I make it a point, and I give at least 100 speeches a year, and we travel incessantly, and I always show up wearing my investment banker suit, and no one could ever accuse me of not having a shower. So, unfortunately, the word has been hijacked by vested interests on the other side of the fence.
But fortunately, people like you are changing that word.
Oh, yes.
The way we see that word.
Yes.
The way we perceive that word.
That's true. But just talking about words, I always say that the most beautiful word ever written at any time, in any language, in any culture, in human history, came from India, from the Upanishads 3,000 years ago. Ahimsa, non-violence to any living being. Mm-hmm. And I think about vegans generally, and I think And people ask me, what religious faith do I have? And I say, actually, I'm ahimsa. I reject violence. It's a new word I invented.
I just cooked it up. I'm using it. I'm stealing it. Ahimsa.
Yeah, it's become a new kind of noun.
Good.
So when they ask me, you know, how I practice this, I just say it's nonviolence to any living being, including yourself. And not just in what I eat, but also in what I see, what I say, what I think, what I do. And that, and I do mean what I think. I don't have violent thoughts either. Mm. And it's very depressing. I can speak as a corporate strategist, because that was really part of my job in times gone by, that vegans are actually their own worst enemy. They refuse to spill the blood of any animal. But on Facebook, they spill real blood when they fight each other, these cyber warriors. And I'm just trying to get the message across. The old Shelley saying, isn't it, that he convinced against his will is of his own opinion still. Don't bludgeon people to death. Give them the information, enlighten them, be welcoming, and you'll have more followers to your way of thinking than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah, there's a lot of angry vegans that are filled with some very ugly thoughts.
Well, in fact, to tell you the truth, I think it's a form of bullying, because vegans have an advantage. We have ethics on our side. The things that we're doing are protecting the oceans, the forests, human health, children, animal suffering. We've got every arrow in our quiver. So therefore, when we are confronted by a carnivore, human carnivore, or as my dear friend Paul Watson would call them, necrovores, if we bludgeon them to death, we're actually bullying them, because we've got more stuff in our armory than they have. So I think it's time for us to lighten up a bit and educate and bring them along to the cause in a gentle, intelligent way, and do so as swiftly as possible.
I like to say that we tune in love here on this show. That's what it's about,
yep.
Because love is the only answer. Now, you've been talking to, you say you give 100 speeches, and you mentioned that you were in Israel, and you spoke to many people in high places there. What happens when people of authority receive your message?
The first response is to be very polite. And if you deliver a message in an intelligent way that they can understand, you and look deeply into their eyes, you can see the mind at work. If the shutters come down, you know you've made a mistake. It's not their fault, it's yours.
Mm.
As I said, people in power, we're often told, you know, we need to have the courage to speak to power or tell the truth to power. We don't need to tell the truth to power. They know the truth already.
Mm.
What we really need to do is give them the opportunity to manifest the power they have in an intelligent kind of way. So if you're dealing with the CEO of a large multinational, for example, you don't show up there with dreadlocks, tattoos, and dirty clothes. But you do go up. People do business with people they like. People take the advice of people they trust. So you need to talk to them in a kind of setting that makes them feel they're talking to an equal. You don't talk to them in a condescending kind of way, and you don't talk at them. That's one of the things we did. If you're interested, I'll describe what we do, if that's not going to be too boring.
No.
All the projects that we get involved with, for management purposes, I put them into silos, because we're in so many countries and we're covering so many issues.
And it's a great term, silo.
Yes. And yes, I often think of, if it is the right term, because I think of a nuclear weapon silo, which is just hardly ahimsa, is it?
Mm.
But I put it in a silo. For example, one would be Kindness House or Kindness Skies, Kindness Oceans, Kindness Kids. So it's easier for me to manage the algorithms that link all the numbers together. One of them is called Kindness House. It's a building of about, say, 40,000 square feet. And there are shops downstairs and upstairs. We have about 350 very, very smart young people from about 45 different NGOs, like Sea Shepherd, Greenpeace, the Wilderness Society, social firms, the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, Lawyers for Animals, Multicultural Broadcasting. You name it, we have them. The creme de la creme, if you like, of active, smart NGOs. What we have been doing is taking small NGOs off a kitchen table and incubating them. What do? We give them money, give them training, and give them offices, fully serviced offices, and they're free. We pay all the bills, rates, taxes, insurance, security guards, air conditioning, cleaning. We have movie theaters, boardrooms, training rooms, kitchens, showers, everything you could put, bike rooms, everything you could possibly imagine. And so they start small, usually with two or three people, and a couple of them have grown to 100 people. And as soon as they're big enough and can afford to pay rents, we say goodbye to them, and we bring in a new group. Now, the advantage of having that kind of facility means that they could contact the CEO, for example, of a mining company or a timber company, and say, we'd like to have a meeting with you. Instead of having to go to a coffee shop, you bring them into Kindness House and have a meeting in a proper boardroom. Mm-hmm. And you present yourself in a very professional, intelligent, rational way. And we've got all the technology that any big corporate can have, you know, high-speed Wi-Fi. So that's what Kindness House does. But that's in the Kindness House silo. And then, of course, we have Kindness Farms, Kindness mobile restaurants, that sorts of things. But that's probably fairly boring, and you want
to go. It's not boring. It's fantastic. You know, I have a small nonprofit. It's called Responsible Eating and Living. I love the name. The acronym is REAL, Real. And I'm just one of many, many, many nonprofits that struggles to do what we really want to do, because we don't have those kinds of opportunities from the beginning. You know, you start with an idea, but it takes funding to do anything.
The real advantage I've found over the last 25 years of having this building is that you've got 45 NGOs, a lot of people, young people, in their 20s and 30s and 40s, all from different walks of life, dealing with different kinds of problems. You know, you might have someone dealing with bears, someone dealing with the timber industries, Sea Shepherd dealing with the oceans, Greenpeace dealing with its own challenges. And they're all in the same building, and they all help each other. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe, just like you do, that I believe in zero population growth and not to have kids. We have two clauses in our lease agreement. If you have a dog and you don't bring him into the office, we kick you out. And if you eat meat in our building, we kick you out. But in recent times, the last 10 years or so, we've discovered that many of these young people in the groups have started dating amongst themselves and getting married and having kids. So I had thought seriously about putting a clause in the agreement: no fraternizing, no marrying each other, no kids. But apparently, you can't do that. It's more's the pity.
That's good. So I was going to ask, and you answered it to some degree, but everyone in the building must know what your philosophy is. Yep. And so do many of them become vegan?
Definitely they do. It's not just the people who work in the building. Remember, someone like Sea Shepherd, they have thousands and thousands of people in the network. So if Sea Shepherd puts on a movie night, 300 people show up. Mm. And, of course, they get the vegan message, too, loud and clear. So veganism is growing as a consequence of the Kindness House initiative, I would say, is growing at a very, very massive rate.
I'm just thinking it wouldn't be hard to solve all of the world's problems. I mean, we have the means, we have the smarts. I'm just thinking in Manhattan alone, we've had so many stories about foreign investors who buy up for exorbitant amounts of money different apartments. And they're just like wait places to store or launder their money. You know, they have these, what do they call them, these anonymous LLCs and whatever. And, you know, we could be using all of those spaces. I mean, they were not even in them for the most part. We could be housing people. We could be educating people. It's just, you know, if enough people with the wealth would put it in the right place, all problems would be solved. Why aren't they all like you?
None of these problems that we just describe are complex. This is not rocket science.
It's not rocket science.
It's really another BGO. In some areas, people are getting it. We're fairly active. We've got about 55 projects, for example, in India. Now, India is a fascinating country. Let's give you an example, okay? Let's pick one city. Let's pick something on the Bay of Bengal in Vishakhapatnam, for example. Animal shelter, they send out, and I'm the patron, so I can speak with some confidence. They send out their money, their dog-catching vans to catch the dogs on the street corners and bring them back to the shelters where they are neutered and spayed and given anti-rabies treatment and kept there for 2 or 3 days. And then they're released back on the same street corner on which they were caught to maintain the carrying capacity of that precinct. Now, rabies, as a consequence over the last 20 years, has plummeted down to zero. So that's a good start. Now, whilst we go there every year for the last 12 years, and we traveled around and we noticed that there were a lot of poor people living in the street, sleeping under a tree or under a shop awning, and they'd have a dog or two for company or security or warmth at night, and they'd beg for food in the street, and they'd share the food with the dog. So we signed a contract with a restaurant there, and a meal is picked up by a vehicle every day, and it's a large mound of rice on a huge banana leaf with a very nice spicy curry poured over the top with the soup, and it's wrapped up and then wrapped up again in newspaper to keep it hot, plus whatever fruit is in season, an apple, pear, banana or peach, plus a bottle of water. And the food is taken down in our vehicle to a certain street corner. The poor people come out, and they've all got photo ID that we've given them, and we hand out the meal. And I tell them all, and you've got pictures of it on our Facebook, I tell everyone, look, this is not charity. Treat this like a stipend. So if ever you see a dog has given birth to puppies, or someone's whipping a horse, or a lorry has hit a cow, go into any shop, they'll let you use the telephone, call our shelter. We'll send the ambulance, and the ambulance has got hydraulics that can even lift a cow, and we'll take the cow back to the shelter or the animal back. And they've said, of course, by all means. So we started, I think, with one feeding station, and we call them a restaurant, and we have 5 at the moment. But my long-term plan is to have 100 of them, and I'm going to brand them like Starbucks, so that when I kick the bucket, when I die, some local guy can come along and take 10 or 15 and divide it amongst themselves. So now we've got the shelter plus the mobile restaurants, the free mobile restaurants. And now we have, attached to them, we have Kindness Farms, all bought in the name of the local NGO, Vishaka SPCA, run by a remarkable man named Pradeep Nath. Now, we've planted between 50 and 60,000 plants on each property, and on each property we have between 3 and 4,000 rescued animals that you can, of every species you could imagine, buffaloes, cows, dogs, cats, emus, turtles, tortoises, birds, you just name it. It's like a Garden of Eden. And each property has a biogas plant on it. We take the cow dung from the cows, put it in the biogas plant. Now we are, I believe, 100% self-sufficient in cooking gas, probably 50% self-sufficient, if my memory serves me correctly, on electricity.
Fantastic.
The slurry that comes out of the gas plant is used as fertilizer to grow fruit, nuts, vegetables, and flowers. And the urine from the cows is used to make Ayurvedic medicines, which is very popular in India. Mm-hmm. It's the traditional Indian medicine. So we have all these kinds of projects that feed off each other and help build the brand, the Vishakha SPCA brand, in that particular state. Now, 15 years ago, it was just a tiny little NGO. Now, Trix and I were driving in a van. I took two Sea Shepherd captains there to India for a month. And we were driving in a van down a street in this crowded, noisy, chaotic street. And another van came tearing past us and pulled up alongside and wound down the window. And they stuck their hands out and gave us the thumbs up to say, you're doing a good job. Of course, we don't speak Telugu and they don't speak English.
But everybody understands a
everyone's
thumbs up.
That. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing that we have been doing in India. And in, as I said, we've got 55 projects in India. I've just described Vishakha.
I'm just filled with so much joy when I hear this. So let's go back to those people in high places when you're approaching them with respect and intelligent in a nice suit. And you're telling them of these wonderful projects that you're doing. Do they think that they can do similar things? Do they get inspired?
I think initially they feel threatened. Oh. Yeah, that, and I don't blame them. And in the early days, I probably did it in a clumsy way, and I don't do that anymore. So the some of them do feel threatened initially.
There's so much ego.
Well, you're challenging something that is so important to them, their taste buds. It's one of the most important senses that they possess. And they've been doing it for 50 or 60 years. So they feel threatened or they feel challenged. But very soon, you can tell when they're listening, they start asking questions. And by the quality of their questions, you know that you're getting through. And once you've got past the barrier that you're not there to criticize, you're just there to give another angle. Now, bear in mind, I spend a lot of my time talking to corporates. I'm talking to CEOs, finance directors, chairmen of companies. And I use an example like this for want of a better term. If I could show you a way that you could be sure that your company would never have its name mentioned on the front page of the newspaper for animal cruelty, or for destroying their customer base, or breaching ethics, or really taking care of the health of your employees. And if everybody knew about that, if the entire community, the entire financial press knew that those were the qualities that your company possessed, what do you think it would do to your weighted average cost of capital? Would it go up or down? Would it increase or decrease your price earnings multiple? Would it attract more high quality employees or fewer? Do you think your stock, your shares, would trade at a premium on the stock exchange or a discount? Now, you can answer all those questions, but I can tell you, if you get even one of them wrong, you ought to be fired. Because they're not complex questions. And not one of them ever gets it wrong. They all know the answer. And once they get their head around that idea, they're very happy to say, well, what do you suggest we do? Mm. And one is you start off slowly. Get your staff involved in coming out to some of the NGOs that we support. All these guys, I can tell you right now, are asset rich, cash rich, and time poor. They don't have the time to do the due diligence that I have. So I make sure that they understand me and they trust me. And if you look at my website, I say, I don't want your money. I don't accept it. But if you want to help, here's a list of terrific NGOs around the world and a link that I've invested in. Go direct to them, develop friendships, relationships with them, give them money, give them advice, do whatever you like with them. All I ask in return is, please don't tell me who you're supporting or how much you've given them, because I don't want to know. But unfortunately, that doesn't work, because as soon as they've given them a grant, they pick up the phone and tell me.
Of course.
But some of the grants have been very substantial.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
I'm talking about several hundred thousand dollars. Now, in the United States, it may be a lot different, but a $200,000 grant to some of the projects in, say, for example, India, Korea, South Africa, $200,000 is life-changing.
Yes, life-changing.
In the United States, it won't even pay the salary for the CEO. yeah. A $10,000 grant in Maharashtra would provide medication for 5,000 injured donkeys. In the West, it won't even pay for the Christmas party. So where do you think I'm going to be spending my hard-earned buck, where I get most leverage, most bang for my buck? As I often say, my mama didn't raise no dummy. So I'm spending a lot of my time, energy, resources, my thoughts, in places like development. And I hate using that term, developing countries, because in many ways they're infinitely more developed than we are here in the West.
I have a problem with that word, too. Do you have any, sir, a better way to describe them? We need to come up with something.
We do, yeah, we do. Yeah. we should stop being so condescending.
Yes, it is.
In some ways, India, for example, is infinitely superior in an ethical sense than some of the countries that dominate geopolitics today.
So what's fascinating, before we started the program, you were telling me you're here in New York and you were in Los Angeles, and people are running up to you and recognizing you here. You're a celebrity. We all saw, many of us in the vegan community have seen that video, Animals Should Be Off the Menu. You're doing great work all over the world in places that need it, where you can get more bang for your buck, and yet here we know all about you.
Well, it's very, very odd. It's for me, because as you know, I've always been a very sort of a shrinking violet. Rupert Murdoch's press once described me as being reclusive. And I must say, that is true. His newspaper got it right. I am reclusive. So it's quite an odd experience for us.
Yes. Okay. You mentioned earlier about the woman in the fur coat. And then you talked about how we need to be kind and respectful to people. So have you had an opportunity to talk to women in fur coats? You said that you in the past you would go up and have a friendly conversation. Do you still go up and have a friendly conversation?
Well, when I first went to Australia, I was only a teenage boy, and I was living rough, I guess. And I had a girlfriend. And she came from the right side of the tracks, and I didn't. And she came from an extraordinarily wealthy family. And she had four or five brothers. And once a year, when the parents were away, the children had a party at the house. And it was called the Uglies Party. And the challenge was for all the young men of the family to go out and find the ugliest woman they could possibly find and invite her to a party. I didn't know anything of this. And, of course, I was invited to, and by my girlfriend. And it was like the Great Gatsby. It was an astonishing, beautiful home and the best food and wine you could possibly imagine. And towards the end of the night, and many of these young women had no idea that they were just part, they were pawns in this rather cruel game. These guys would go out to bars and try and find the ugliest girl. And at the end of the night, they would congregate in one room, and the guy who brought the ugliest girl would win a prize, a very expensive prize. Anyway, because I was considered the serious boyfriend, I was allowed to sit in the room and choose the ugliest girl. And my girlfriend's name was Sally. And I sat back on this huge leather, can you believe, lounge in front of the fire, leaned back, and I was 20 years old, skinny, scrawny, in fact. I leaned back and said, well, tonight I think I'm going to nominate the winner of the Ugly Prize to Sally, because only a woman who could wear the fur of a dead animal on her back and think she was chic could really win this, prize. And how I got out of there alive that night, wow, heaven only knows. But I didn't see her again until 30 years later, when I was giving a speech in this particular city in Adelaide. And I'm standing on stage, and I looked down from the stage into the auditorium, and she was sitting in the second row. And I looked down, and the lights came up, and I looked straight into her eyes, and I thought to myself, Sally, dear Sally, if the competition was held again tonight, you'd win again. You're still as ugly as ever. So that's my first story.
Wow, what a courageous person. I love that story. And just such a horrible thing, the uglies. I imagine they kept that thing going even after that experience.
It's possible,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
Did the women know?
No.
In the end, they never know. They were just taken home. They never knew they were part of this ugly event.
I don't know. I was the first to leave. Well, I was the first to be shown the door.
Well, I'm not surprised. Anything is possible, apparently, on this planet. Wow. Okay. Well, I've kept you here a long time. I just can't help myself because you're fantastic, and I want to be with you for as long as I can. So you're here in New York, and you're leaving tomorrow?
We're leaving tomorrow.
You're going back?
Yes.
Okay. Have we fed you well?
Yes.
Can you tell us where you've been?
We're actually staying at the Cornell Club, mm-hmm, and you won't believe it. They have a little sign saying, if you're vegan, let us know and we'll cater for you.
Wow. Yep.
So, and they've done
it. Is the Cornell Club related at all to Cornell University?
It is, yes.
Okay. So maybe T. Colin Campbell had a little influence there somewhere.
Yes. Well, every year we give an award to somebody who's done something great throughout their lives. It's a gold medal. And it's $25,000 as a prize. And over the years, we've given it to some wonderful people, like Kamenika Gandhi, Paul Watson from Sea Shepherd, Jane Goodall, who are the others? Pradeep Nath from Vishakhapatnam. A couple of years ago, I gave it to Colin Campbell. But last year of the year, and Peter Hammerstedt, also from Sea Shepherd. But a few years ago, I had the pleasure of giving it on stage to Sir David Attenborough. And this year, in a week's time, I'll be awarding it to, this time it's going to go to an American.
But we don't know who it is yet.
I can tell you because it'll be a secret. It's Chris D. Rose from California, Last Chance for Animals.
Oh, yes, of course. I think I might have read about that. Have you announced that at all yet?
We've told him, I think.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Yes, what a wonderful
Chris is
human being.
He's a terrific man.
Yeah,
he's the real deal.
Yeah. So, have you been able to talk to people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, the good guys who have money and want to do good things?
No, I haven't.
Talk to you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're doing great things. I think if they focus their attention where I think it really matters, if they really want to make a serious difference, if they want bang for their buck, and in the process they could get a Nobel for it, they should take on the cause of getting this planet to veganize itself. Because it's fine curing diabetes. I'm all in favor of that through surgery and drugs. But there are better ways of alleviating the suffering and the torment that happens. And people like Gates and Buffett and many others, the real leverage in the future, people often ask me, you know, what does the future look like? You know, what's the future for GDP or interest rates or foreign exchange prices? And they ask me those kinds of complex questions. And I say, it doesn't really matter what the question is. The answers are always the same. India and China, India and China, India and China. And that's a fact. So I think if the real heavy lifting of the future is going to happen in India and China, it will happen a lot quicker if people in the West would help that process, because we are good communicators. And I think if Warren Buffett, for example, and Bill Gates through their weight behind it, you would get some of the serious money in China, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, to rally to the cause. And we would not have to worry about 2048 anymore. We could have this problem licked in 10 years. And economies would boom. Health standards would improve. Animal suffering would diminish asymptotically down to close to zero. And because I think ultimately in the end, only three things matter: how deeply you loved, how gently you lived, and how gracefully you let go of things that were not meant for you. Meat was not meant for you. And it's really that simple.
Beautiful. And I don't think I've ever heard it said better. China and India definitely are the tipping point of whether it goes one way or another. We read so much about how their consumption of animal foods are going up, and they're working towards increasing that amount. And I mean, it's already a disaster with the West and how much we consume, but as their appetite increases and their ability to grow more animals increases, it's just a disaster. So the disaster can either speed up really quickly, or if they get it right, go in the other direction.
Well, if you look at, we've just come back from Africa, and you see how much land is being bought by China. I'm talking about massive amounts of land for agribusiness. They're doing the same in Australia. They're doing the same in South America. But there is something that gives me hope. Let me tell you something about the Chinese. Once they decide to do something, they will do it immediately. Mm. And if it's good, they will do it even quicker.
Wow.
So there is...
Okay, there's hope. Government did come out and say they wanted their people to reduce the amount of meat consumption.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So we'll just see where that goes. Okay. Anyway, you said have you been eating the whole time at the Cornell Club, or have you gone out and about and been to any of our restaurants?
No, we've been to many restaurants, many of these beautiful salad places that on every corner.
Yes.
You trip over them. In fact, as soon
as I like to end on a delicious note, so I want to hear about where you've been eating.
I couldn't tell you the names of the places, but I do know that when we leave, there is bound to be a famine in New York, because Trix has eaten all the food in New York City.
Okay. Have you been to any of the Candle restaurants or the Blossom restaurants?
No, I have not.
You haven't. Have you been to vegan restaurants or just restaurants that offer vegan options?
Ones that offer vegan options.
Ah, you just go anywhere and see what they have.
Yeah, we're used to that. We travel so much, and I found that if you become too focused on only going to a vegan restaurant, mm-hmm. you'll spend all your time. Whereas if you go to a normal restaurant and you say, by the way, I'm vegan, everyone hears you.
Yes. So, well, I've been doing that for most of my life, traveling around the world, and I've never had a problem.
Yes.
I haven't been to Australia yet, and I'm looking forward to that. But I did live in Europe for a while and been around Asia, and I'm still here. I've never had a problem eating.
Well, I don't know how you survive. I don't know where you get your protein from.
All right. Yes. Okay, so do you have any plans for the rest of the day? On this rainy day?
The only place we haven't been to yet is the Statue of Liberty. And every time we try to go there, it's been fogged out. But rain, hail, or shine, we're going there now.
You have to go. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the Statue of Liberty means a lot to me, and it means a lot to many people. And right now, with our current government administration, the symbol of the Statue of Liberty is really being questioned and compromised, and it's heartbreaking. And I think that statue represents so much, even from a vegan perspective, you know, the idea that everyone is entitled to liberty. And I don't think that's just humanity, of course. I think that's all animals. And I'm always so moved when I go. I've seen her numerous times. It's a really a lovely space, and way that they've improved upon it, where you can listen at so many different spots to the history. Everyone should go.
Well, we went to the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, and I promise you, I had a lump in my throat, because I saw in every sad story, and there were literally millions of them, the live animal export industry that sends innocent animals on death ships against their will to far parts of the world. One of our projects is in Egypt. And let me tell you, every penny I invested in the Bassatine slaughterhouse in Cairo to try and stop the egregious cruelty, where they stab the eyes out and they slash the tendons, every penny I invested there was utterly wasted. And seeing those sad stories, and in a sense, uplifting stories at Ellis Island, it affected me profoundly yesterday. I came away, I had to sit down and have a coffee and just gather my thoughts again. And I think the American story is fascinating, and so one that I think a lot of people take for granted, the notion of liberty. When you look at the number of great minds that actually came to the United States from other parts of the world to live here, they didn't come here for money, the really great minds. They came here for kind of intellectual, spiritual, if you like,
for
freedom.
An ideal.
And I think in some respects, the risks, the existential risks to the United States is that source of intellectual energy may find another home. They may go somewhere else. They may go to Oxford or Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. President Macron was just inviting all of the best and brightest to France.
Indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know the Japanese universities are doing the same. And that would be, in a sense, a shame for the United States.
Well, I'm for whatever makes the world a better place.
Right.
So let's end on that. Thank you, Philip Wolin, for joining me on It's All About Food. Trix, very nice to meet you as well. And I still can't believe that I met you.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. And I'm Karen Hartgless, everybody. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a very delicious week. Bye-bye.